This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Author and journalist Jonathan Coleman joins us in studio for a conversation. Jonathan, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Coy.
Now, how long have you been in Charlottesville? It's about 10 years?
I actually have been here 20 years.
20 years?
I had been a student here in the early 70s, graduated in 1973, and was invited to come back to teach for what I thought was just going to be a semester in the fall of 1986. And here I still am, 20 years later, much to my surprise.
So you were at UVA with a generation of, let's see, Bob Gibson and Larry Sabato and George Allen. You were sort of on grounds when they were all here, weren't you?
Yeah, Bob was a couple of years ahead of me. Larry was a year behind me. And it was an interesting time, to say the least, to be in college.
Yeah, absolutely. Where to start? Can we start with just a Jonathan Coleman 101 to introduce folks to you? Because if I have anything to do with it, you'll very quickly be a regular on this program. And just introduce yourself to folks, a little bit about your background. And you are a celebrated and best-selling author, but there was a long foreground of journalism before you started writing books.
Well, actually, I've been on, it seems, every corner of the table. I was a worked for a literary magazine in London for a year called The New Review. I worked in book publishing, first in publicity, then as an editor at Knopf and Simon & Schuster. Then I made what some people thought at the time was a ridiculous move from book publishing, where I was almost to be an editor-in-chief, and I took a pay cut and I went to work for CBS News in the early 80s, first as in an off-camera position and then as a correspondent. And it was at CBS that I began work on two stories that became my first two books. So I wound up leaving CBS after 2 years to become a full-time author in 1983.
And the first book, if I'm not mistaken, At Mother's Request, is that right?
At Mother's Request, which was a true crime story about a mother who persuaded one of her sons to kill her father, his grandfather, out in Salt Lake City, Utah.
My God. And then, and that was followed by Exit the Rainmaker?
Exit the Rainmaker came out a few years after that. Again, a story I first started at CBS about a college president from Southern Maryland who one day just picked up and disappeared. He was supposed to go to his dentist at 11:30 one Wednesday morning. He had other plans that he had actually formulated 6 months earlier.
And folks, if you have not read this book, it's Exit the Rainmaker, and it is fantastic. And you, of course, knew this instantly, that this is an incredibly gripping story that has to be told.
Well, what I felt about that story was about something that many, many of us only fantasize about doing, and very few of us cross the line and actually do it, though many more than you think actually cross the line and do it, and that includes both men and women. So it was a phenomenon.
Just pick up one day and disappear.
Pick up one day and disappear. They haven't committed a crime, though whether you consider it a moral crime or not is a separate issue. But they haven't stolen anything. They haven't embezzled. They haven't written bad checks. They just want a change. And this is a pretty extreme form of effecting such a change.
Jonathan Coleman is our guest, and the book we're talking about is Exit the Rainmaker. Excuse me, was that followed by Long Way to Go, or was there a book in between there?
No, there was going to be a book in between, and that book would have been a book on Little League, which I wrote an article about. And I actually followed a Little League team here in Charlottesville, and then I ultimately went on to the Little League World Series, even though no team from Charlottesville did. And I later decided that once I wrote the article, that was all I really wanted to say about Little League at that time, and I was really eager to work on this book on race in America.
Tell folks about this book. It's an incredible book, and it got a lot of attention, and it actually led to an appointment by President Clinton at the time. Is that correct?
That is correct. that book started as a magazine piece about Maya Lin, the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, whom I had done a 60 Minutes piece on at CBS about the controversy over the Vietnam Memorial. Maya was commissioned to do the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. She hadn't done a public piece of sculpture since Vietnam, and I was curious to see from Vietnam on what she was going to do with her life after having done the Vietnam Memorial. So I started on this piece, and I went down to Montgomery, and as soon as I started to talk to people about the memorial, what they really wanted to talk about was what was going on in the country at that time, and the feeling that under President Reagan, the country had started to move backward, not forward, in terms of race. And I started to really look at that and ask myself the essential question, how far has the country come since the civil rights movement, and maybe even more significantly, how far does the country want to go?
And, of course, the title says it all, A Long Way to Go. And thoughts since the book came out? It's been about a decade since the book came out. What are your thoughts now since then?
Well, it's interesting. I was startled the other day to get a call from Marquette University, and they said, we'd like you to come out in April. We want to look at Long Way to Go 10 years later. And I said to myself, could it possibly have been that long? The title is not meant to be as negative as it sounds. It really is meant to be, we have made a great deal of progress, but we still have a long way to go. And I think in some respects, I still feel that, though the issue of race has become much more complicated since I wrote the book, because at that time, I was really looking just at black-white relations, which is really what people think of when they hear the word race.
Right, right.
But if I were to do that book now, I would certainly look at the Asian population, the Latino population, all of those
things. The Native American population.
The Native American population really has to be looked at if one was looking at race closely and deeply in the 21st century.
Author Jonathan Coleman is our guest, and the phone lines are open if you have a comment or a question at 977-1070. Jonathan Coleman is our guest in studio, author, journalist. Let's talk about the projects you're working on now. I understand that you are currently writing your next book, and
yes,
I'm very interested in hearing about
that. I'm struggling to finish it. I had never written a book about anyone that I knew before I started reporting a story and writing about them, and for the very reason that I thought that this book, which is about a man who was a mentor of mine, a famous book editor named Angus Cameron, who was blacklisted during the McCarthy period, I thought it would be my easiest book to write. And it actually has turned out to be my hardest book to write because I was so close to him, which is not to say that the book is going to be completely idolatrous. It's not that. It's just that his death, which occurred just before he turned 94, and he was actually living here in Charlottesville. That was unusual. He lived the last 7 months of his life here and had partly come here because I was here, which is an unusual thing in itself. Usually a writer moves to be close to his subject, but in this case, Angus had moved here partly because I was here and partly because his daughter moved about an hour from here. He was living at the Colonnades. And so when I contracted to do the book, I had no idea that I would be that closely involved with his last X number of months, which is, I think, has given the book, will give the book, an even richer dimension than I hope it has already.
Yeah.
The working title for the book is What He Stood For, The Many Worlds of Angus Cameron. And it's a book in a way that looks at what it takes for someone to make a decision to stand their ground at a very difficult time during the McCarthy period and basically lose his livelihood over principle. And that's sort of the core of who he is. And I think it's not as if anybody knows him as a household name. They don't. But his life is emblematic of many things that I think people can emulate and learn from.
You know, Jonathan, it's so interesting when we think of, well, history has taught us, when we think of the blacklisting of that era, we often think of Hollywood, and it's primarily, I guess, because Hollywood often tells those stories,
right,
and is the loudest storyteller in the world. But there were a lot of folks in New York in publishing who were affected by this.
Well, not a lot, actually, but Angus was the first one, and some of his authors, in fact, were some of the Hollywood Ten. But because he published a number of books that were disquieting to the government, he was the one that they came after.
And was he just run out of the business, or did he gradually fall out of favor, or was it just overnight where he couldn't get a job?
It wasn't overnight. Arthur Schlesinger actually tried to get Little Brown to fire him, but they actually told Schlesinger that he could go elsewhere. So they stood behind Cameron. But at a certain point, the atmosphere just became too difficult. And Angus's position was, you know what I'm doing when I'm not here. I've told you if I'm making a speech or whatever, I've been very straightforward. But for you to ask me to tell you, to basically report to you, to sort of have you approve what I'm doing, right, that I can't agree to.
And was he a practicing communist in America?
No, or? He was somebody who you could say had a did not adhere to party discipline, but was sympathetic to party values. He was really a true radical.
Yeah. Well, you know, these days, if John Stewart was doing what he does now, if he did it under McCarthy, he'd be out of work. He'd be completely gone.
Absolutely.
And there's a whole lot of people now who we hear from and we need to hear from, whether it's satire or a direct speech against our leaders. I mean, here in Charlottesville, we should always think of that. That was Jefferson's great intent. Always question these folks. Always question what they're doing.
And I've tried to actually learn from those things in Angus, even in the way I parent my own daughter, which is always challenge the status quo, always challenge whatever is put forward as received wisdom. Question it. It's why not? Because, you know, there's things that you can add to that discussion.
Author Jonathan Coleman is our guest. You had an article recently in the Washington Post that got quite a lot of attention around the country and especially here in Charlottesville. Where did that come from and how did that happen?
There's a place in Charlottesville called Main Street Market, and it's a place where I often have coffee in the morning. And I had learned secondhand that John Grisham had a little parking problem early in July. And the image of him rushing to save his Porsche Carrera from being towed, frankly, was just was too rich not to write about. And yet at the same time, I knew that it was a kind of tipping point for the things that really stir people up, whether parking is free or not, the tension between owners and tenants in a building. All those things are really quite universal. And what I didn't know at the time, but I found as I sort of went through the piece, is the piece, I think, is almost a vehicle to look at how Charlottesville has changed, even in terms of people's attitudes. And there was a tremendous outcry, whether it was on the Charlottesville News blog, the Jaquith blog,
CivilNews.com,
or even the comments that were written in to the Post. One man in Sterling, Virginia, said, free parking is not a constitutional right in Virginia. And there were people who were very much in support of Grisham's position.
Which was what? For the folks who didn't read the article, what was the problem that he had?
Grisham's position was that it was up to the owners of Main Street Market, not the people who have their businesses there, to create more free parking, really, for the ultimate customers. It certainly would benefit the small business owners, but for the customers. The owner's position was more spaces were offered to the tenants of these buildings at a more reduced rate than Adelphia was paying. They chose not to take advantage of this reduced rate. So there were all sorts of questions of sanity were raised. Grisham raised the question of sanity on the part of the owners of Main Street Market. The owners of the Main Street Market, in turn, said it's not our sanity that should be questioned. It's really the sanity of the owners of the businesses that should be questioned for not having sort of committed to more parking at a reduced rate. And it's all that sort of back and forth.
Because when it gets right down to it, he was really ticked off that his car was going to be towed.
He was ticked off about that, but his point was, and I think it was more the lawyer in him that was making the point.
Yeah.
Look, I spend $300 a month at this place. I don't want to pay to park. And people were sort of outraged by his position. Some were very sympathetic to it, but other people said, look, if you can spend $300 a month at the Main Street Market, you can certainly afford to drop a quarter in a machine. He'll survive this. He was a great interview. He was very good-natured about it. He was a little bit taken aback that I had learned about it. But once he knew I'd learned about it, he very openly talked to me about it.
And what does it, real quick with the minute we have left, what does it tell you about Charlottesville? Because you've been here quite a long time. I mean, back to the early 70s as a student hanging out in Charlottesville on the corner. What has changed?
Well, I think
good
Charlottesville,
and ill.
I think Charlottesville has, in some level, become somewhat rarefied. The people who live in Charlottesville, and I love it here in Charlottesville, they totally believe in Charlottesville, and they believe in the notion of Charlottesville as the greatest place on earth. That in and of itself is something that a writer like myself would poke fun at. And it is a nice place to live, but it's a place now where you can get rather easily all these exotic things, hand-rolled Mennonite butter. I said in the article that the Main Street Market offers more cheeses than the law allows, and that was when there was a place that's no longer there now called Cibolet, had a good number of unpasteurized cheeses, which actually they weren't allowed to sell, but they did sell. And so the Main Street Market, in a way, represents a place that offers things that you can't get everywhere else. So there's, by its very nature, there's an elitism about it.
Right, right.
But as somebody said, actually one of the owners of the market, what's everyone complaining about? This article is only going to increase the business of the market because it is going to tell people this is where John Grisham shops.
Yeah. Author Jonathan Coleman, our guest. Will you come back?
Oh, I'd love to come back. Thanks for having me, Cole.
Would look forward to it. Let's take a break here at the bottom of the hour for some local news and weather.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.